Hi everyone, welcome back for a new episode. Thank you so much if you're back again, and if you're a new listener, welcome. This is a great episode today. I've got a college campus near Toronto, Ontario, that used to be an insane asylum, and another story about university dorms in Montreal, Quebec, that is haunted by children that perished in a tragic fire in 1918. I would also just like to say that if you have any suggestions for season 3 or comments on what you would like to hear more or less of next season, please let me know. You can send me a message through my website at realscarypodcast.ca or through my email, realscarypodcast@gmail.com. Now let's get into the show. The first location I'm going to talk about is the Humber College Lakeshore campus, located in the area of Etobicoke, I hope I'm saying that right, in Toronto, Ontario. Be sure to check out the images on the blog so you can see how the buildings are laid out. Beautiful brick buildings labeled C through K make up a portion of the campus. Now, the history of these buildings goes all the way back to 1888, when approval for a 52-hectare asylum was approved to start construction. So yes, the college was once a place called Mimico Insane Asylum. Back in 1850, the Ontario Lunatic Asylum opened and was the largest building in Ontario. It was during this time that mental health was becoming a disease that was recognized in the mental health world as something that could be treated and cured rather than locking a person away in jail. Now, back in this time, mental illness included a huge range of things, some legitimate illnesses and many that were not at all. This was during the asylum era, and the issue of overcrowding became a huge problem. A suggestion was made to move the, quote, chronically insane to a new location, and thus was born the Mimico Asylum. The patients themselves actually built most of the buildings. This was labeled by Dr. Joseph Workman as, quote, moral management. He believed that productive work, such as the building of the new hospital, was therapeutic. So since this was part of treatment, they were not paid for the work that they did. So did he really believe this, or was this just a way to get free labor? Who knows? This type of work continued through the 1940s, where male patients were often the ones to build, renovate, or repair buildings. They would also often work the farm and do cleaning. The female patients were placed in more feminine roles, such as laundry, cooking, and gardening. The patients were also brought in to assist with the construction of coffins and even in the burial of fellow patients. So this is so sad to think about, and I'm not sure what the argument was in this case to justify someone who's already struggling with mental illness to have to help bury their fellow patients. This institution may have been born out of the overcrowding issue at the larger provincial institution, but this very issue would quickly become a problem here as well. In fact, this was a problem at pretty much all institutions like this in the world. The conditions in the hospital would slowly decline over the decades Mimico was open for. During the Great Depression, the hospital would see substantial overcrowding, and in spaces meant for one, there would be four patients. This, among other things, contributed also to the decline of the standard of care as well. So let's talk a little bit about the courses of treatment that were common in these times. Keep in mind that while a lot of these treatments now may seem horrific and more like torture, at the time they were being done, they were on the cutting edge of medicine. The intention of the therapies were born of good intentions, I believe. However, the main issue was that to the public, doctors and nurses, not all, but many, believed that people who were mentally ill were not like a normal person. They couldn't feel pain like us. They weren't worthy of proper treatment because they wouldn't know the difference. So this is the thinking that turned these treatments into torture and almost justified abuse to many people who worked in these places. The father of American psychiatry was a man named Benjamin Rush. He believed that pretty much everything wrong that could happen to someone, including mental illness, was that of something undesirable present in the bodily fluids. so he would bloodlet or purge his patients in various ways. Another doctor by the name of Henry Cotton took things a step further, and between 1907 and 1930, he would remove infected parts of the body. Rotting teeth, intestines even, gallbladders, and certain parts of the colon, among many other things. This, of course, caused many deaths. Another doctor, Dr. Julius Wagner Jauregg, won the Nobel Prize in 1927 when he founded a treatment that included injecting the patient with malaria-infected blood to induce a fever. It was believed that since fevers stopped the advancement of syphilis, that it would surely stop the symptoms of schizophrenia too, right? Makes sense. And many passed from this course of treatment as well. So these are some of the things that occurred during those beginning years of psychiatry. Out of this came some of the more well-known and commonly associated treatments that come to mind when people think of an old insane asylum. Shock therapy. Now, when I hear this, I picture the paddles being brought to someone's temples, the lights flickering. And while this form of shock therapy was used, there was also another type that was very common that I hadn't heard about before. That was to inject someone with insulin, sending their body into shock and ultimately causing an insulin coma. It was believed that when they were revived from the coma, their madness would be cured. Other drugs were commonly used to bring on convulsions and seizures with the hopes of physically shocking the body and mind back to normal. And after that is when they started bringing in electricity to actually, truly, physically shock the body. The next common treatment is the lobotomy. This began in the 1940s, and it sought to damage the prefrontal cortex of the brain, which was believed to cause the mental illness. Lobotomies were performed originally by drilling holes into the skull to gain access to the correct part of the brain. Later, it was refined to the transorbital lobotomy, which was when an ice pick type tool was pushed through the inner eye socket and into the brain. The pick would then be moved around and damage that part of the brain. The patient would be left with a black eye, but what a small price to pay to be cured, right? Well, not so much. The results were described, even by the doctors doing it, as mixed. Some patients ended up committing suicide, some were left severely brain damaged, but all, absolutely all, lost something in this operation. Something that made them them. Part of their personality, memories, or even that spark that just makes someone unique. By the 1970s, lobotomies were essentially eradicated. These were essentially a couple of the most well-known therapies and were some of the things that were used in the Mimico Asylum. Funding at Mimico was drastically decreasing. Most patients were not even buried in marked graves, and it's believed that violence became a daily occurrence. No doubt there would have been some employees who were trying their best, but in an asylum so overrun with patients and not enough staff to go around, it certainly would have been nearly impossible to provide acceptable care. Now, as I mentioned, there were either no records kept at Mimico or they were just lost or destroyed, so we don't know a whole lot specifically about what went on there. So think about the treatments used. The fear and the pain that must have ran thick within these walls. And no wonder there would be, at the very least, some residual energy left behind. Another part of this place is that there was a tunnel system, which seems to be pretty common in most hospitals, but also back then in these asylums. So it was a convenient way of moving between buildings with food, supplies, and even patients. Now, the hospital eventually closed in 1979 after it was declared that Victorian asylums were symbols of inhumane and monstrous treatment of our mentally and physically ill. Most of the patients were simply turned out on the streets, and this was not unique to Mimico. This happened all over the world. These patients would become homeless, and even some would break back into the hospital, as these were the only places that they knew as home. In the early 1990s, the buildings were taken over by Humber College. So it shouldn't be a surprise to know I say that all the time, that this location has many paranormal stories attached to it. I did see that the college has moved away from talking about ghost stories on campus. They're very against that, from what I've heard right now. In the past, however, there were a couple of articles where they did talk about a few of the stories, but as I said, that seems to have stopped. I did read in an article in the torontoghost.org site, I'll have links on the blog, about a security guard who began working at the campus. There were many stories he heard of, and of course he just took them as silly ghost stories. One that he had heard was that a couple of students were exploring the tunnels. When they began to walk back to the stairs, they heard whistling from behind them, but when they turned, they saw nothing. They reached the stairs and they heard it again, but this time there was also a cold gust of wind accompanying it. Another story was of a construction worker who was doing work on these same tunnels. When he came around a corner, he saw a woman in front of him. It was really, really late at night, and there shouldn't have been anyone else around, especially not a woman in a nurse's uniform. He called out to her, but she rounded the corner. When he went around the same corner, she was at the far end of the hallway already. It would have been nearly impossible for her to get there that fast. She stood still, and as he approached her, she turned to face him, and supposedly she had only a blank space where her face would have been. So definitely spooky, but this security guard sort of just laughed them off. The first couple of nights, he said, things were pretty uneventful. Sure, he was a little creeped out by the old morgue, but who wouldn't be? On the third night, he locked the buildings and set the security alarms. He was passing a building when he saw movement inside. He looked in through the window and saw nothing, reconciling with himself that if someone was in there, the motion detector would have gone off. But just to put his mind at ease, he decided to check it out. As he entered the building, and just as he was switching on the lights, he heard a loud whack sound. And when the lights came on, the garbage lid was spinning around like someone had just smacked one side of it. He checked the can to see maybe if a mouse or something had fallen into it, but it was clear. In fact, it had a brand new garbage bag. He radioed the other guard and told him there was an intruder. They checked the place from top to bottom, but found no evidence of anything. As they turned off the lights, he heard someone sigh from the stairwell nearby. He claims that he left in one hell of a hurry. Now, of course, there are many stories of creepy and uneasy feelings, especially in the tunnels. Other people talk about strong feelings of being drawn to be in certain areas on the grounds. On the same site, there was another story submitted by a former student who said that she was one of the first students in one of the newly renovated buildings. This student was sitting near their locker in the basement, studying after classes, and believed they were alone. While concentrating on their work, a woman came through what this student thought was a locked fire door in the middle of the hallway. She had long brown hair and a white linen gown. She was moving slowly and obviously caught the attention of this student. She went up one of the stairwells at the end of the hall, and the student felt compelled to follow. When they entered the stairwell, the stairs were empty and the fire door at the top of the stairs was just closing loudly. The student is adamant that the speed she was going, she could not have gotten up and out of that door in time. Sounds a lot like that nurse. There are also stories of hearing humming and childlike singing in and around the building that housed the children's unit. There's also a story of a ghost who haunts the F building and is identified by the strong flower smell that will accompany her. Back to the tunnels, though, it's supposedly common to hear footsteps, doors closing, and whispering. Many people believe that the old cottages in particular are still haunted by spirits of patients. Keep in mind also that it's entirely possible there are still many buried on the grounds, as many were unmarked. So this is a fully running college currently. They have done some heritage tours in the past. And I did find a few instances where they also toured the tunnels. So if you want to visit the college, it may only be possible in those few ways. So I would maybe check out their website or their Facebook page around Halloween. but otherwise remember to please respect that this is a running college. The next place I want to talk about is the former Grey Nuns Mother House in Montreal, Quebec. This location actually gave me a nightmare, I will say. This has never happened to me before, but obviously it really stuck with me, so let me know if you have one too. So the story of this place begins before the original structure was even built. The year was 1752, and a man named Jean-Baptiste Goyer lived in a farmhouse on this property. He lived next to a wealthy couple, Jean Favre and Marianne Bastien, who would be brutally murdered and have their belongings looted. Now, Goyer claimed that he was on a trip in his canoe when this would have happened. He seemed horrified by the deaths, but suspiciously was spotted later spending copious amounts of money at a local tavern. Unsurprisingly, this made him a suspect in the eyes of many, and it seems as though they didn't even consider anyone else once he was in their sights. The only plan then was to extract a confession from him by any means necessary, and back then, the method chosen was something called the Spanish boot. Basically, the accused's legs were nailed to planks of wood. Under this torture, Goyer did confess. He was only trying to take their money, but he ended up killing them. He was then set to be executed. Now, I've read a couple of different accounts of what happened at this point. One account says that he was dragged by horse until he died, and another account says he was executed by something called torture wheel. Someone would be attached to a flat wheel, and it would be revolved slowly while smashing the person's limbs with a hammer. Either way, he was killed, and a blood-red cross was erected at the spot where he died and was buried. This was supposed to be a warning to others to not commit murder. Personally, I think the torture wheel and Spanish boot would have been at least enough warning for me, but anyway. Now, his body supposedly still remains under René Levesque Boulevard. But about 100 years later, the nuns of the Mother House moved the cross and repainted it, more of a brownish-red color. The cross remains to this day, though it isn't directly on top of the body anymore, it is still there. So now let's get into the Mother House. The nuns' work actually began in 1734, when Marguerite Diouville and three other women committed to helping those in need in New France. They moved around between shelters and eventually took over a derelict hospital. Marguerite passed away in 1771, but her vision of expanding the hospital was something that the other nuns kept alive. The hospital was expanded in the 1830s. The nuns were invited to many communities over the next 30 years to help set up orphanages and schools, and this was across Canada as well as the USA. Due to the hospital's close proximity to the water, being at the old port in Montreal, there had been much flooding over the years, and it was evident that a new building was desperately needed. The new building would be called the Mother House, and was designed by architect Victor Bourgeau. The building began to open in 1871 and would fully open at the turn of the century. It was a beautiful building, and still is, actually. And certainly a change from the derelict hospital they had become used to. The Mother House became a pillar of sorts to the community and housed orphans, the sick and poor. They saw people through the First World War, Spanish flu, and the Great Depression. It was not without tragedy, however, and in 1918, on Valentine's Day, a massive fire broke out in the orphanage that saw the deaths of at least 53 children. Now, the number is definitely thought to be higher, as many of the children would have been cremated by the fire. Most of the babies were put to bed as usual, and by approximately 8 p.m., a fire had all but engulfed the fifth floor of the West Wing. Soldiers who were in the infirmary were among the many firemen and basically anyone able-bodied enough, including some of the nuns, to try to rescue the children. Some were seen running out of the building with a baby under each arm, only to turn around and run back in for more. At first, it was believed that faulty wiring was the cause of this fire, which then caught the curtains and quickly spread. Now, even more tragic, the fire would later be confirmed to be an arson. An orderly named Bertha Courtmarsh, age 27, confessed to lighting the fateful fire. In her confession to police, she said that she had crept out of bed, set a fire to a pile of newspapers that she had placed behind a radiator in the room where the baby slept. The curtains then caught fire and she went back to bed. She said, "God knows why I did it." Once she heard the screams of fire, she rushed into the fire and brought out two babies. It should be noted that her proclivity, quote unquote, to set fires had been previously known, and that she had actually been sent to the convent only a few days before this fire, in an attempt to cure this urge of hers. Safe to say, it didn't. Now, there are no known photos of her, and I have not been able to track down anything that happened to her after her arrest on September 18th. The few articles that I read about this also said that it's not known what happened to her. So as the years went on and fewer nuns joined the Grey Nuns, they announced in 2004 that they would be selling the grounds to Concordia University, who officially purchased the building 3 years later. The building was eventually decided to be utilized as the new student residences and was unveiled in 2014 as Concordia's Grey Nuns building. It boasts 600 study spaces and 600 beds. There's one part of the building, however, that remains owned by the Grey Nuns, and this is a place in the basement where 276 people remain to this day. The basement crypt houses 232 nuns that have passed away in its centuries as the Mother House. The remaining bodies are said to include those of the children who were recovered after the fire. The crypt is, of course, off limits to anyone but the nuns, though it can apparently be seen through the window of a locked door. Now, the remains were originally planned to be moved, but since some of the sisters had passed of infectious diseases, this was the agreement that was made. So, I find this so creepy to think about, and this was the part that actually gave me a nightmare. But the fact that this building is a dorm, I just can't imagine falling asleep knowing there are almost 300 bodies in the basement. Though I'm sure, and I don't mean any offense, I'm sure it's a peaceful place and a nice place for them to come and pay their respects, it still just freaks me out. Now that we know the history of this amazing location, I think it would be pretty predictable when I say that most of the paranormal claims revolve around the children who were killed in the fire in 1918. There is a daycare in the new building, and they have said on multiple occasions that they've noticed the kids talking to an imaginary friend. Though that's not strange, kids have imaginary friends all the time. But the weird part about it is that all of the children describe the same young boy with burned and tattered clothing. A student who moved into the dorms began having visions of burned children and the sounds of trampling feet. She tried everything to get these visions to stop, but the only thing that worked was moving out of the building. Now, she was not the only student that has claimed to experience nightmares that feature burning children. Others have claimed to also hear the sounds of crying from the top floor of the West Wing and running feet in the corridors. Some students who were interviewed have said that they definitely find it creepy and that most of the time it's all anyone can talk about. I haven't heard anything about people seeing nuns, which also wouldn't be surprising, but maybe because they're all at rest and peaceful in the basement. But these poor children, however, that seemed to remain were snuffed out so suddenly. I will also say that it opening as a dorm is pretty recent. To be opening in 2014, it's only really been open for 6 years. So we have some stories, but I'm sure there will be many, many more stories in the years to come. There is a ghost tour offered in Quebec. I believe it's a bus tour, and they do stop and talk about the Mother House and also talk about Jean-Baptiste Goyer. So if you're in Montreal, be sure to check this out, and I will have the information up on my website. Thanks so much for listening. If you've had any experiences at either of these places, please let me know. I've been getting some emails lately from people just sort of dropping in a line to say hello, and even a few who have had stories or suggestions to share. So I love that. So thank you so much to those people who have reached out. And to anyone else thinking about it, shoot me an email at realscarypodcast@gmail.com. You can also message me on Facebook or Instagram. Both are at realscarypodcast. Don't forget to check out the blog for this episode at realscarypodcast.ca. This is going to be my last episode before Halloween. Halloween is going to be a beast. So I am planning on 2 episodes a week. So hopefully I can pull that off. So I kind of need some time just to help get everything ready. I will also be doing some giveaways. So I'm really excited. I've been sort of collecting things over the last few months. So I'll have some Real Scary merch. I'll also have some stuff from the Lucan and Area Donnelly Museum. I will have some Haunted Walk stuff. So definitely make sure that you check that out. And like I said in the opening, if you have any suggestions or tips for me for the next season, please let me know. Until next time, this is your friendly neighborhood host, Elise.